With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. A new avocado variety will soon hit the market. It's more than 50 years of plant breeding in the making and development by UC Riverside agricultural scientist. The avocado is called Luna UCR, and its lineage began with a Haas avocado in 1938, which integrated into a Phil avocado in 1954 and a Gwyn in 1983, and now, 30 years later, is the Luna UCR. The variety offers great flavor with a rind that turns black when ripe, a high post-harvest quality, and growers can appreciate the smaller tree sizes, which mean denser plantings to allow for more efficiency when harvesting and pruning. And now it's time for us to get into our show headlines. Sourcing labor stretches outside the ag industry. A shortage of willing and reliable workforce isn't just impacting the ag industry. Anna Genasi of Stanislaus County explains more.
It's really interesting now that we've gotten involved in this workforce development thing and working with our liaison. His name is Chris with the county. He talks about this is not an ag-specific challenge. So across industry, folks are kind of seeing this attitude, for lack of a better word, of I want to work when I want to work, how I want to work. And if the employer's not willing to meet my goals, then I'm not going to work for them. So it's really interesting dynamic. And obviously, in terms of ag and our industry and our timely needs, right, harvest and things like that, that poses some big problems. If we think that folks are coming to work today and then they don't.
And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
There's some important overlap between ag tech innovations and development of biological products. VP of Innovation with Western Growers Walt Duflock said the convergence of technology with the biological sector will ultimately pay off for agriculture.
If you look at where the farm is going, you've got these new biological solutions. They're increasingly mixing with the chemistry solutions, and they're increasingly able to do more with genetics than even some of the chemistry can do. So I think genetics are helping with that. And then at the same time, automation comes along because the stuff that's easy to automate, we want to get automated, like Burrow with Harvest Assist, like some of the sprayers with Gus. And when we do that, we free up the labor to then go to other places. So if we can free up the limited labor we have, and as you know, the domestic labor is shrinking, the H-2A labor is increasing and getting more costly. So let's maximize labor we do have. Let's automate what we can, and then let's get them over here. I think a lot of these kids, they'll end up working on the robots, but they'll also end up working with the biologicals, and we support all of it.
A new Avocado Scion cultivar developed at UC Riverside is being made available for growers. Professor of Extension and Subtropical Horticulture Mary Lou Arpaia describes some of the attributes of the new Luna UCR variety.
So the first thing is that when the fruit ripens, it ripens a dark skin similar to a Haas. So it could be classified as a Haas-like fruit. So it's green on the tree like Haas. Late in the harvest season, it'll turn dark on the tree just like Haas. But when you ripen it, the fruit during most of its season, you harvest it green and it ripens to being a black-colored fruit. So it's Haas-like. So because of that, the interesting thing about it is that in avocados, you have two flowering types. You have A flower types and B flower types. And Haas and Gem, which is another up-and-coming cultivar, and Lamb Haas, which is another variety that people grow, they're all A flower types. And people commonly plant B flower types to be a complementary flower types.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, U.S. Senator Gary Peters of Michigan is taking another swing at the SWAT Act. He, along with Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Mike Braun of Indiana, and Jeff Merkley of Oregon, reintroduced the bipartisan Spotted Wing Abatement Trust Act, which would reduce the spread of spotted wing Drosophila, also known as SWD. The act would also advance research on this invasive insect that is hurting fruit growers and their crops across the country.
It's about the economy, it's about jobs, and it's important for us to make sure that we're dealing with an invasive pest that is causing tremendous challenges. In fact, I think some of the numbers I've seen is in a year, over $700 million of economic impact as a result, not just of blueberries, but cherries and other specialty crops that get hit by this little tiny invasive fruit fly, the spotted wing fruit fly. And that's why it's important for us to figure out a way to deal with this problem.
The spotted wing Drosophila is an invasive pest that originated in East Asia. It lays eggs in soft-skinned fruit crops such as blueberries, cherries, and strawberries. Peters talked about the SWAT Act while touring the Crossroads Blueberry Farm in West Olive, Michigan. Farm owner Luke DeHaan talked about how the pest affects his business.
The stores have zero tolerance for this, so unfortunately, as soon as we see blue fruit, we have to prevent that. So that's spraying every 5 to 6 days, and as you can imagine, that's very costly. So on a certain general, from a spray material side, we're spending about $800 an acre, and on this pest, it's costing us at least $200 an acre. That was a couple years ago, and so at least a quarter of what we're spending our money on material-wise is to take care of this pest.
Michigan Blueberry Commission Executive Director Nancy Nyquist was also on the tour.
SWD is a very significant problem for the blueberry industry here in Michigan and in other states as well. The Blueberry Commission has supported in the past work research to help combat this.
Michigan State University professor Rufus Isaacs was on hand to talk about the pest and the problem it causes.
We've been working in partnership with the industry to develop methods to control it, to protect the fruit so the growers can harvest safe and nutritious food. But we really wanted a biological approach to this so that we would have a non-chemical way to manage this insect. So colleagues of mine from other universities had gone to Asia, where this insect is originally from. They collected various different parasitic wasps, tiny, tiny little things that I will show you today. And those wasps were evaluated, and one particular species was found that was very selective for this spotted wing Drosophila. So that wasp is now approved by the USDA for release in the United States. We're doing, this is now our second year of doing releases with this wasp here in Michigan. And so last year we were able to get enough wasps to do releases at 6 blueberry farms and also some cherry farms up in Traverse City. And this year we're expanding our capacity to do this, to go to more farms, raise more wasps, do more releases. But we're really limited in our capacity to do that by the amount of resources we have. So the blueberry industry has helped us with that. MSU has helped us with that. We've also had some funding from a team across the United States that we're part of. But we're really constrained by the resources to be able to do the hundreds of farms that are in Michigan or across the country. So the SWAT Act that Senator Peters has led would help us get those resources to make this much more of a standard way of managing this pest, reducing that chemical input and making our management of this pest so much more sustainable.
Senator Peters plans to push for the bill to be included in the 2023 Farm Bill. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, we told you late last month that the National Milk Producers Federation had sent a letter to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration noting they must end dairy product mislabeling by manufacturers of synthetic, cell-based dairy ingredients that are in violation of federal dairy standards of identity. The letter concerns a product made by a company called Board Cow. In an interview with the National Association of Farm Broadcasters, NMPF's chief counsel Clay Detlison explained why they sent the letter.
Well, National Milk has been at odds with the Food and Drug Administration for literally four decades over FDA's lack of enforcement of labeling requirements. In particular, we've been fighting with FDA for their not enforcing the standards of identity for dairy. And we actually saw an announcement that Sprouts Market was going to be carrying Board Cow in its grocery stores. And we see that what they're doing is taking one whey protein that's synthetically made by precision fermentation, concocting that with a myriad of other food ingredients, which are pretty disgusting sounding in many cases, and calling the product dairy milk.
And Detlefsen says you can't duplicate milk in the lab.
Milk has got 13 essential nutrients. It's got 400 different fatty acids. It's got two categories of proteins, casein and whey, numerous micronutrients. And it's an incredibly complex matrix that delivers an enormous nutritional package for consumers. And you cannot replicate that in a laboratory or elsewhere. I mean, milk is milk. It's natural and it's good for you. And you can't duplicate that in a lab.
Now, NMPF notes the urgent need for the FDA to enforce beverage standards of identity as lab-based milk imposters try to use dairy terms in the marketplace. You can learn more about this on the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. And this week, cattle industry leaders praised the introduction of bipartisan congressional resolution recognizing the importance of commodity checkoff programs. That includes the beef checkoff. National Cattlemen's Beef Association President Todd Wilkinson said, as a cattle producer who invests in the beef checkoff, I know how important this program is to the continued success of America's cattlemen and cattlewomen. The beef checkoff was created by cattle producers, it's run by cattle producers, and provides immense benefit to cattle producers. He said, I'm proud of Representative Barry Moore from Alabama for leading this resolution and standing with cattle producers to recognize the importance of checkoff programs, and I hope more members of Congress listen to farmers and ranchers and reject animal rights activists-led proposals like the OFF Act that undermine producer control of checkoffs. Now, every time, of course, cattle are sold in the U.S., $1 from the sale goes to support the beef checkoff. And these investments are collected by the Cattlemen's Beef Board. To learn more about the checkoff, go to the Beef Board website, beefboard.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
And now, another episode of One Soil to Live.
All right, let's take a look, Claude. I see you've been keeping it covered.
Yes, I have.
And it appears you haven't disturbed it.
Well, I've tried really hard not to.
You're using living roots throughout the year with diverse species in rotations, right?
Just exactly as you prescribed, Doctor.
Well, I'll have to say I'm impressed with your organic matter, aggregation, and microbial activity. Claude, I'm happy to report that your soil is fit as a fiddle.
Oh, thank you. I guess it's true that soil health management systems are just what the doctor ordered.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Improving soil health can make your farm more productive, profitable, and resilient. Visit your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today and learn more about the basics and benefits of soil health. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The call to keep AM radio in vehicles continues to grow. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Senate Bill 1669 is the AM Radio in Every Vehicle Act. The bill requires the Department of Transportation to issue a rule that requires all new motor vehicles to have devices that can access AM broadcast stations installed as standard equipment. Emergency management groups have joined in supporting the bill because AM radio stations provide necessary information to the public during emergency situations. The National Association of Farm Broadcasting also involved in supporting the bill. NAFB President Joe Gill says the organization believes this is an important issue.
It plays a very important role in informing folks, but also keeping people informed when it comes to weather and other issues, emergency alerts.
Gill says having solidarity with the emergency management groups is good for the cause of keeping AM radio in cars.
I think their message is so important and so great to hear that.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. The IRS is out with its Dirty Dozen tax scam list for 2023. You may have seen some of them being pitched on TV or other media sources. A couple of the scams also include farmers as their target. One of the tax scams on the IRS Dirty Dozen tax scam list involves the Employee Retention Credit. It is true that some agribusinesses are eligible for the ERC, but most farmers didn't experience the drop in revenue needed to qualify or have payroll sufficient to even explore ERC eligibility. The companies pushing the ERC tend to charge high fees and not inform you that the credit must be removed from business expenses, such as wages. Another one on the list is the fuel tax credit. You can claim a fuel tax credit for business use of fuel you paid tax on, but the fuel must be for off-highway or farm use. Charitable remainder trusts are also being pushed by some as a scam. It's a good estate planning technique, but the scammers are misusing the concept. Also on the IRS radar are monetized installment sales and syndicated conservation easements. Monetized installment sales can work, but they must be set up properly and you have to know how they function. But stay completely away from a syndicated conservation easement. It's simply not worth the risk. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Russia is stopping the Black Sea grain deal once again. Russia's halting the Black Sea grain deal again, and it threatens global food and fertilizer prices as the war in Ukraine grinds on. The Black Sea Grain Initiative has been a global food and fertilizer lifeline for nearly a year, but Russia says not yet to extending it again after a previous extension ran out. USDA chief economist Seth Meyer told this year's Ag Outlook Forum ending the deal would be a blow to Ukraine and the world.
My concern would be if the Black Sea Grain Initiative does not continue, they will have to rationalize production further down. The Black Sea Grain Initiative is serving a very important purpose to get that product out.
Key for developing countries in Africa and the Middle East, where food costs first soared when the war broke out. World wheat and fertilizer prices spiked nearly 30% in the immediate aftermath of Russia's full-scale invasion. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Many experts agree that the climate is changing and not for the better, and we've been seeing it this summer all across the country.
The smoke from wildfires burning in Canada, the extreme heat waves blanketing parts of our country, and the severe flooding and precipitation events in the Northeast, the drought out west.
That's White House National Climate Advisor Ali Zaidi listing just a few of the extreme weather events that we've seen just over the last couple of weeks.
And that's why it is time for us to articulate back a bold response to the climate crisis.
Part of that response,
setting a goal to reduce our emissions by 50 to 52% by 2030 and unlocking the incredible economic opportunity that tackling the climate crisis represents.
An economic opportunity, especially for the nation's agricultural producers. The agriculture secretary says to fight climate change, the nation's farmers and forest owners need to be encouraged to adopt even more climate-smart production practices.
But to do that, we have to have accurate, reliable measurements of the impact and effect of the changes and the practices that we're embracing.
And so Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has just announced a major investment to do just that.
Today we're announcing our intent to direct up to $300 million of the inflation reduction resources from the Inflation Reduction Act to this very important task of ensuring that we are properly measuring, monitoring, reporting, and verifying the results of climate smart agriculture and forestry.
Two specific goals for this investment.
One is improving our estimates of greenhouse gas mitigation outcomes associated with specific conservation practices. And the second major goal is improving the timeliness, reducing the uncertainties as we put together the U.S. National Greenhouse Gas Inventory.
Vilsack told reporters part of the money will go to establish a couple of networks, one for soil carbon monitoring and research, and another for greenhouse gas research. But
this opportunity is more than just collecting information. more than equipping our farmers and ranchers with better tools. It also supports the work in terms of the advancing the notion of climate smart commodities.
Commodities that could bring a premium to producers if they can verify that their ag practices actually reduce greenhouse emissions or hold more carbon in the soil. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Selling in the grain trade doesn't appear to have a lot of follow-through, though the upside looks limited for now. I'm Mark Oppold with your Bottom Line Report at midweek, brought to you by Helena Agri. Bottom Line analysts provide some numbers, support levels in the grain and livestock trade to watch into the end of the week. December corn has continually tested that $5 level since July 4th. We see a trade below $4.90 as a buying opportunity, but as mentioned, $5.18, $5.22 on the upside, we think brings sellers back in. November soybeans approaching $13.90, $13.94 is going to begin to hit a wall, but they built solid support around $13.05 in our view. And September Kansas City wheat appears to have good support at the $8 level, but has been helped out by that slow harvest. This is the Bottom Line Report. October live cattle ran out of steam a week ago today above that 184 level, but should hold above the 179. August lean hogs have been riding the coattails of a strong July contract, but October futures lag over $10 behind. Keep an eye on that $90 level basis August. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Clay Detlefson, Senior Vice President and Staff Counsel with NMPF, says the organization wrote a letter to the Food and Drug Administration about the fake milk product.
Well, National Milk has been at odds with the Food and Drug Administration for literally four decades over FDA's lack of enforcement of labeling requirements. In particular, we've been fighting with FDA for their not enforcing the standards of identity for dairy. And we actually saw an announcement that Sprouts Market was going to be carrying Boerd Cow in its grocery stores. And we see that what they're doing is taking one whey protein that's synthetically made by precision fermentation, concocting that with a myriad of other food ingredients, which are pretty disgusting sounding in many cases, and calling the product dairy milk.
He says FDA needs to knock off this nonsense and nip this in the bud. Milk cannot be created in a lab.
Milk has got 13 essential nutrients. It's got 400 different fatty acids. It's got two categories of proteins, casein and whey, numerous micronutrients, and it's an incredibly complex matrix that delivers an enormous nutritional package for consumers. And you cannot replicate that in a laboratory or elsewhere. I mean, milk is milk, it's natural, and it's good for you, and you can't duplicate that in a lab.
The lab-based milk situation is similar to the plant-based milks.
It's the same in that people are taking liberties with existing rules and regulations and largely ignoring them and doing whatever they want. Sloppy marketing, if you will. Lazy marketing. It's different in this case because whereas the plant-based people were trying to distinguish themselves from dairy milk, these synthetic people are trying to say that they are in fact dairy milk, which, as I told you before, couldn't be further from the truth.
Detlefson talks about what steps National Milk wants the FDA to take.
Enforce its rules and regulations send a clear message to the plant-based folks and the synthetic-based folks that the rules are on the books. They, like everyone else, have to follow them. If they don't like them, then they can petition the government to have them changed. But until they're changed, everybody needs to abide by these rules and regulations.
He says they're optimistic the FDA will take a look into the issue that NMPF identified in their complaint. Again, that's Clay Detlefson of the National Milk Producers Federation. Chad Smith reporting.
It all started the year that this Beach Boys song was a big hit.
Serving U.S.
1963, when the United Nations created an organization called CODEX. Now, if you go back to 63, that was when...
Bond. James Bond.
The James Bond franchise was just beginning, and you may remember Bond was always battling these evil criminal organizations like Smersh and Spectre. And when I first heard the word CODEX, it sort of reminded me of one of those organization names, CODEX. But of course, let's make it very clear...
It is not an evil organization.
He's laughing there. He knows I know a little bit about this little known but very important scientific organization. That was Dr. Emilio Esteban there. He's the Undersecretary of Agriculture in charge of food safety. And he says these days, most of us are eating quite a lot of foods produced in other countries, and the U.S. sends a lot of its food and ag products to other nations. So we all enjoy a wider variety of foods than we did back in 1963. He says, thanks in part to CODEX. It's a scientific group charged with coming up with common quality definitions for food products traded internationally and with agreed to global safety standards for those foods. Here's an example. Let's take tomatoes. Before CODEX standards were set, there may have been really no global standards for tomatoes. So one country might have one definition of what a tomato is. Another country might have another, which could lead to a lot of misunderstandings between buyers and sellers. To avoid those kinds of problems,
you need to agree on the shape, the size, the color, all of those things that make the quality of the product be defined as a tomato.
So CODEX sets those kinds of standards for thousands and thousands of food items, including tomatoes.
And that way, everybody in the world that wants to trade tomato does it with the same definition of that specific product.
But Dr. Esteban says besides having an international standard for quality and such,
I want to make sure that everybody meets the same level of safety. So for that, for example, I set a standard that the food cannot contain X amount of a microorganism in order to be safe for consumption anywhere in the world.
So CODEX sets safety standards for many, many foods around the world, but does not set standards for how to pronounce them.
You like tomato, and I like tomato. Tomato, tomato, oh, let's call the whole thing off.
Somebody in New Zealand may call it tomato. And somebody in Germany may call it tomat. And somebody in Mexico will call it tomate.
Yes, we pronounce it differently.
But at least everybody defines it as certain circumference, certain color, certain density, certain texture.
So that's the kind of thing that CODEX has been doing for the last 60 years, making it a lot easier for food products to be traded around the world. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do you listen?
It's just nice to have local.
I listen from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night.
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
It keeps me up to date with everything going on in the world.
When you put the lights on the barn, the radio went on.
It moves pretty quick so I can get the message and get on with my day.
Well, listen in the barn, skid loader, tractor, and just about anywhere you can.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Wheel. This week, we have another Almond Matters episode brought to you by Valent USA. And in today's episode, growers are working to get their last pest management programs in place before whole split.
In today's Almond Matters segment, we've got Todd Bergdahl here with us again. He is a field market development specialist with Valent USA. And now, Todd, we're here in the middle of July. Temperatures are finally hitting those prolonged periods of triple digits. And so just want to check in and see what growers will have top of mind here with whole split on the horizon.
Yeah, Brian, quite a contrast from the last time we spoke. You know, the weather tends to compensate. You know, if it's cool spring, it turns into a hot summer. And the hot summer is definitely upon us. With a hot summer comes a higher fecundity of our pests, mites, navel orangeworm, namely those two, I think, are problematic. And then there's leaf-footed plant bug out there, too, that's causing some problems. But mites are finally starting to show up. It's late. So people that didn't put a miticide on, it would be a very good time to do that before harvest, because when you get into harvest, you have multiple varieties and you have to turn the water off to get harvest done. Trees stress even more, and then the mites kick off like gangbusters. And, you know, I've seen years where almost complete defoliation because of mites that were, you know, running rampant later on and during harvest. So if you haven't done a miticide application, if you've got any mites at all showed up, I would say treat them right now. You know, it's preferably spray at night, slower drying time, get good coverage, spray with coverage in mind, and knock out those mites. The other thing is navel orangeworm. As we're coming upon hole split here in the next few days, couple weeks here, it'd be probably a pretty good idea to, I know a lot of people have introduced mating disruption, and it's working very well for a lot of people, but it's not 100% the use of some type of insurance there. If you're going to go out with a miticide, probably be a good idea to put something in softer chemistry so you don't disrupt the beneficials. BT Dipel is what, you know, works really well. A pound of Dipel is relatively inexpensive, and it's cheap insurance against navel orangeworm. Again, coverage. You've got to get good coverage. And before hull split is always better than afterwards, because once the hull split happens, it's actually too late. The little baby Lepidopteran worms have already moved into the interior of the nut, and the damage is being done. So those would be the two top of the things on the top of my mind right now as I've, you know, starting to heat up here. Also, you know, weeds for harvest, any weeds out there that, you know, you see your weeds start breaking through, your pre-emergence start breaking through if they're put on back in January, February. You know, they last typically about 6-7 months. And so post applications, or, you know, for weeds is also a good thing at this point. Grasses tend to show up around the emitters along with spurge. Usually you have to use a combination product, you know, or something to burn back those weeds so, you know, they don't disrupt or foul up harvest as well. But the two big things is mites and navel orangeworm, and staying after those and being aware of those, as most people are. You know, I mean, I know the nating disruption has been accepted as being a pretty good tool across the board. I know fields that I looked at last year that were full of inundated with traps of navel orangeworm. I went out last week and there was very few, if any, of the traps had any navel orangeworm in them. So I'm thinking, wow, this stuff is really working well. But there's still a few that escape it. And that's the justification for a pound of Dipel with a miticide spray really works well to keep those populations even lower than, you don't want any navel orangeworm in your nuts. Anyway, as far as the season goes, it will heat up, and it looks like it's going to be hot for the next couple of weeks here. So that's going to be an amplification of pest fecundity.
And now I'm curious, you mentioned mating disruption there, and that seems to be getting more attention here in the past few years. But from what you're seeing, though, sounds like it's pretty effective. But maybe you just want to put some other applications out there just to be certain, and maybe mop up what might still be out there.
Yeah, I mean, I always look at, you know, pre-hull split applications. I mean, you know, if you do a good job early on watching traps and treating accordingly. But sometimes these navel orangeworms, you know, they can get it off, you know, they can blow in. It doesn't have to be from your orchard. It can be from somewhere else that they blow in. We have had a couple windy days last week, you know, and they're not a real strong moth. So, you know, wind carries them. But anyway, having Dipel as a back pocket remedy, the thing about Dipel is it's soft on beneficials. Okay. It's basically a Lepidopteran product. It only kills Lepidopteran larvae. Won't kill the adults. They have to ingest it. Acts as a stomach poison on the larval stage of Lepidopteran navel orangeworm worms. And so they have to ingest it. Getting good coverage is really key. But once they ingest it, they stop feeding, and they'll die within 2 to 3 days afterwards. So the cessation of feeding is really key, because you don't get any more damage. it is, again, you know, the soft chemistry. It works well as a soft chemistry. So if you got predators out there working on assassin bugs and stuff like that, that I see, I saw a lot of assassin bugs lately. I don't know why, but they're out there feeding. And Dipel doesn't have any activity on assassin bugs or any other predator for that matter. You know, there's one thing I will mention, Brian, is we have a new formulation of Zeal this year, the Zeal MVP. It's an EC material, works really well. It's shown very good efficacy across the board. It, coupled with Dipel, is a really good tank mix. I did some work on that previously, you know, for tank mix compatibilities and whatnot. You want to mix the Dipel in the tank first and then add the Zeal MVP afterward. So the wettable powder, wettable granules of Dipel go in the tank first. That's the only caveat, is mixing that first. Zeal, again, you know, is basically an IGR-type material, so it stops the growth of nymphs going to the next stage of growth, sterilizes the females. The eggs of the females are sterilized as well. So they're both contact materials. They need good coverage. So spraying at night, slower drying time, getting good coverage, going slow, spraying with coverage in mind is really key, especially when you have full canopy out there right now. So you know, the set this year across the board is lighter. I would think a lot of trees, orchards that I've seen, it's not a real heavy fruit set. So, you know, nuts should be valuable come fall. Supply and demand kicks in and, you know, the price should be good. So saving what you got is really key. You don't want to take a bunch of damaged nuts to the processor.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. The approach is within the spotted lanternfly strategy. USDA recently partnered with a spotted lanternfly working group to develop a five-year plan to control an invasive pest. Matt Travis of USDA's APHIS discusses the aspects within this plan.
The approach really focuses management efforts at and near high-risk pathways within satellite populations and near agricultural areas of concern in states where spotted lanternfly is found. The plan also offers great recommendations on how to build response plans, preparedness plans, and really build those capacities for states where spotted lanternfly hasn't been found, and really prepare the state for the day that spotted lanternfly may show up so that they have a plan ready in hand to be able to respond and react when that day comes. Certainly the plan builds additional focus on resources and research, especially new pest management tools, options, biocontrol options, especially is important as long-term strategies to be able to control and manage the populations of spotted lanternfly in the U.S. And finally, we really are focusing outreach, and because it's just proven to be such a critical tool in our efforts to further both public awareness and industry awareness to better protect industries that are at risk.
Travis goes on to explain the history of the spotted lanternfly in our country and its threat as a crop pest.
The spotted lanternfly is an invasive insect that's native to China and was first detected in PA in about 2014. It has since spread to 13 additional states, including Connecticut, Delaware, Indiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Rhode Island, Virginia, and West Virginia. And the spotted lanternfly, it feeds on a wide range of fruit and ornamental trees and woody trees. It does prefer to feed on the invasive tree, Tree of Heaven. It's one of its most preferred hosts. But they also like to feed on other varieties of crops and plants, including grapes, apples, hops, walnuts, and hardwood. And really, we've seen the most damage, the most impact to grapevines. And it acts as a stressor to the grapevines, feeding on the grapevines, eliminating that important sap and nutrients from the vine itself, and then weakening the vine over time so that the vine, with all the other stresses, simply may not have the ability to continue to be productive.
USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service is hosting another Conservation Outcomes webinar tomorrow beginning at 10 a.m. NRCS has been hosting a series of one-hour virtual workshops on a variety of topics related to voluntary conservation efforts on working lands. Tomorrow's webinar will highlight research on the use of precision ag technologies for cropland phosphorus management. Dr. Douglas R. Smith from the USDA Agricultural Research Service's Grassland Soil and Water Research Laboratory will share findings from collaborations with the USDA Conservation Effects Assessment Project. Some of the information will include field studies focused on reducing fertilizer runoff and increasing profitability by prioritizing high-yield areas for crop production. No registration is required for the workshop, which will be taking place through Microsoft Teams. More information about the webinar is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Lawmakers introduce a Women in Agriculture bill. Lawmakers recently introduced the Women in Agriculture Act. The legislation would establish a research priority for agriculture machinery and equipment designed to be used by women and create funding set aside for childcare facilities in rural areas. This bill also creates a Women Farmers and Ranchers Liaison position at the Department of Agriculture. Although the number of women in agriculture industry is growing, the majority of tools are designed and manufactured to the height, strength, and body type of a man. Representative Shelley Pingree, a Democrat from Maine, led the introduction of the bill. She says, quote, "The Women in Agriculture Act provides resources specifically for women farmers and ranchers to level the playing field and work toward a fairer agriculture industry." In 2019, women accounted for 26% of the farm labor workforce, a 19% increase since 2009. However, farms operated by women earned 40% less income compared to male-dominated farms. NAFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.